Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I forbindelse med at vi har publisert en ny episode på Patreon, så legger vi en av de intervjuene vi har lagt ut tidligere ut. Det her med Sam Lessin, som var med en tidlig sjef på Facebook, og nå VC-investor. Veldig, veldig interessant fyr. Mye interessante ideer og tanker om det som skjer nå.
Ja, da har vi akkurat, egentlig nå ligger litt, jeg har akkurat gjennomført intervjuet. Jeg gjorde det sent i går kveld, for at intervjuobjektet var på vestkysten, og da det ganske mange timer forskjell på oss og dem, men vi har gett opp, da i går gjennomført intervjuet med Sam Lessin, som en veldig interessant tenker i det tidlig fasemiljøet av investorer som i USA, og han har vært ansvarlig for din profil på Facebook i mange år, og han har vært involvert i veldig mye og sett veldig mye av det som skjedde på oppbyggingen under Silicon Valley de siste 15-20 årene. Hva du synes, Peter, om intervjuet?
Altså, Sam er jo nettopp av de grunnene du nevnte, en spennende person, spennende fyr, og typisk vestkyst, så rett på sak, og kan uttale seg om det meste, så han snakker med stor entusiasme, som man gjerne har i det miljøet også, men vestkysten er jo spesielt for dette. Vestkysten er USA, mener jeg. Så jeg synes at jeg smilte og humret da jeg hørte intervjuet, men det er selvfølgelig, altså, i tillegg til det, så er det jo kunnskap da, han deler. Kunnskap om bransjen og hvordan han ser på ting, men også om andre aktører i bransjen som det kan være verdt å høre på. Du forstår sikkert hva jeg sikter til da.
Ja, nei, det var mye interessant å komme ut der. Skal vi bare starte intervjuet?
Ja, det synes jeg. Gleder det.
Før vi starter intervjuet her, så vil jeg merke at det litt sånn varierende lydkvalitet. Det teknisk komplisert å intervjue folk med høyt tempo og mye på timeplan. Så han hadde dessverre en svak mikrofon som han brukte. Og jeg kunne ikke korrigere det, vi var på veldig tight timeplan. Så det jeg valgte å gjøre var å rekonstruere dataen. Enkelte ord vil falle bort. Du hører dem hvis du har på deg hodetelefoner. Hvis du vil ha originalfiler, så er det en veldig brutal lyd. Den er tydeligere lyd, men er veldig brutal. Så du kan ta kontakt med oss hvis du vil ha originalen. Men jeg tror vi valgte den beste løsningen med å rekonstruere den på denne måten. Så håper ikke det er for irriterende. Det viktige er at budskapet kommer tydelig frem, og det synes jeg han var helt fantastisk å snakke med. Nå starter faktisk intervjuet. Thank you so much for doing this. And before I start, I want to sum up your resume. You're a Harvard graduate. You started at Bain Capital, started Drop.io. It sold to Facebook. And you are an intern at your wife's company, The Information. And you run the VC firm, or I guess the seed firm Slow Ventures, and you have a podcast called More or Less.
Yeah, is that about right? That's about right. I mean, I was at Bain and Company, not Bain Capital, which, believe it or not, are two different things, but very related concepts. And yeah, but that's basically correct. Nice to join.
Thank you so much. And speaking of Bain and Company and Harvard, where did you learn more about business, like from one or the other? Or I think you're a New Jersey native, right? So you can add watching The Sopranos as a third option.
Well, you know, honestly, I probably learned the most about business from my dad from a very young age. Just, you know, made a point of bringing me to a bunch of meetings I had no business being in. So I learned a lot kind of watching him in that early world of, you know, 2000s era tech kind of evolved. You know, at Harvard, I learned nothing about business. Because Harvard, you know, is really very academic versus it's not meant to be practical education at all. I did a field of study. I was in a program called social studies, which is a mixture of economics and history. And it was super cool. I met some of my closest friends in the world who I've continued to do business with for 20 years. And like, it was a great experience, but it was not a business experience. Bain was interesting. I think the quick version on Bain is I learned the emperor has no clothes, right? So I was a kid who probably left Harvard thinking that the world was pretty sophisticated and people knew what they were doing and trusted authority. And then you kind of go work at a consulting firm working for the biggest companies in the world and realize no one has any idea what they're doing. So why not go do it yourself?
And speaking of your dad, you since we have so little time, I have so many things I want to ask you, so I got to rush through it a little bit. Speaking of your dad, I read the story about before the founding of Facebook, so maybe you can verify it or not. So when I think about Mark Zuckerberg, who I gather you met in college, most people that met Mark Zuckerberg almost casually would be very lucky just to have met him. But I suspect from what I've read that it might be inverse, that he was lucky he met you. Because I think that your dad helped with the first part of the financing. Is that right?
No. So first, I would say Mark's an incredible guy. I'm lucky to call him a friend. And he would have been, you know, he was doing his own thing. He was doing great on his own. I've had a lot of fun with him over life. I've had a lot of good debates. I'd like to think I contributed a little bit to the history of the company. But that's all. You know, my dad, my dad was an angel investor well before it was cool, in the 1990s, and did a lot of it. And I, at one point, you know, way back in the day, had introduced Mark to a few folks, you know, when they were thinking about doing financing, including my dad, who all passed him the deal or didn't do it. So my dad had nothing to do with the financing of it, nor did I. But we were certainly around in that era, for sure.
Is the movie right? Is it correct?
You know, you're talking about the Social Network movie?
Yes.
So here's what I basically say is the movie got a bunch of little quirky details very nicely right. Like, you know, they had the right furniture in the corner. You know, like, it kind of looks like Harvard. There's a bunch of little cute inside jokes that it's right about. The actual narrative of the movie, I was completely made up, right, in terms of, like, what actually happened. It's a great, unfortunately, a really fun film. Like, I think it is a well-made, fun movie, but total fiction. Is the reality in terms of the actual story, which makes it a little bit cringy to watch if you know too much. So, but I love his other films.
It's very good, but movies are often like that. Totally. It's a good story.
Totally. Well, the unfortunate part when you kind of have been too close to a story is that all the other good stories that you think are real, you start to say, well, wait a minute, if I know for a fact that this is all made up, how do I feel about these other ones? But, yeah. You know, it is what it is.
And thinking about current events with the new book on Sam Bankman-Fried has made a lot of people reconsider other very famous business books.
Fair enough.
Can you tell me about Drop.io? How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, like, it was a great early startup experience. I mean, you know, I left Bain & Company. I said to myself, what is the opposite of Bain? And again, that's with respect for people who work at Bain. I think they're smart people and they do cool stuff. Just was not for me. And so my friend and I from Bain started a company called Drop.io that was kind of a very early Dropbox-esque competitor helping people share files. You know, we raised venture capital when that wasn't a thing kids did. You know, YC, I think, had just started and had a few people. It was not normal for people in their early to mid-20s to have raised venture capital. And so it was kind of like a unique, interesting thing to have done. The New York tech scene era was super interesting. There was a lot of great people running around. A lot of them are friends to this day. So it was an awesome thing. And the company ultimately, I'd say it sort of worked. You know, we got a lot of users. We built a cool brand. I had an amazing set of experiences. You know, I was on the original Amazon Web Services customer advisory board with a bunch of CTOs because we used a lot of their services early. We were big adopters very early of Amazon Web Services and things like that. So it was a cool experience. But ultimately got to this point where, like, candidly, like, it was an okay business, but it didn't really matter, right? Like, you know, there was going to be a bunch of people doing versions of file sharing in different ways. Sure, you can make money at it. And, you know, I have respect for guys like Aaron Levy, who kind of also were doing file sharing in that generation and kind of have ground it out, like, you know, doing enterprise. They've kind of turned it into public companies. But, you know, look, especially given what was going on the rest of the internet and how exciting things were at Facebook and the opportunities there, you know, when Mark offered to buy the company and have me, you know, come, you know, run profiles and do it's kind of an obvious decision that, you know, we should do that and, you know, do well for our investors and move on.
So you literally were in charge of every profile on Facebook?
Yeah. So when I joined Facebook, I was in charge first of the profile. So basically the profile page, what went on it, you know, how it was designed, evolving it. You know, we did with Sample Timeline with that. I also ended up being in charge of a lot of the privacy frameworks and posting frameworks, location products, you know, for a while, the Open Graph after that was launched. But, you know, I was on a small group of the management team. There's about six of us that reported to Mark and ran everything, you know, on the product side. So it was a really awesome time to do that through going public. I learned a ton. We had some good impact. We had some great debates. You know, there are things I'm proud of. There are things I wish had been done differently. But that's kind of, it was a hell of a period, no question.
What was it like? You joined in the late 2010. That was quite an electric time.
It was awesome. I mean, like, I think that it's like one of those things where, like, it's, you know, I feel very privileged to have been kind of at the white hot center of that, you know, when things were really interesting and changing fast and growing really quickly. You know, the company was, it's just, it was an electric time. And there was the sense, which was true, that, you know, people want to believe that the work they're doing matters. And a lot of times it's bullshit, right? Like a lot of times in most companies, what you're doing might be a good way to make money, but it doesn't really matter. That was a time when it did matter and you were in a small set of rooms, you know, with really interesting people making really important decisions. And I don't know, it was totally, to your point, it was electric. I remember I saw my mom at one point, she came to visit and she's like, you're like high. Cause we were just, we're working constantly. And like so excited and engaged in what we were doing. But it really felt like a really special time.
That's kind of an interesting point you bring up, the high of succeeding. Often people that start businesses, I've started some businesses and probably will again. And there is definitely a high. It's hard to come down from it. And since it's from inside you, how do you manage that? Like, even for today, you seem like a person who has so much to say, and you have so many opinions. You're very contrarian. And how do you handle performance from then to now? Like, do you have like a secret, like a daily routine? Do you do something like avoid news, or do you lean into news, or exercise, or something like that?
Well, I definitely, if you know anyone, like I definitely lean into exercise. I am very committed. You know, I work out with a trainer multiple times a week. I like really believe in fit and healthy, and I think that that's like an important thing to me. I do find exercise to be incredibly relaxing, in like a good way, especially like really hard workouts. So like I absolutely believe in that. I'm the type of guy where if I don't work out or use my body for a few days in a row, I definitely go a little crazy. So that's important to me. I don't know. I mean, I think, like, you know, I'm not sure I have many great answers beyond that. Like, I don't, you know, I have a lot of signing. I think what I do is cool. I do think one of the challenges, I will say, is that if you've gotten to work on really important things and spent time doing things that are really high octane, there is a lot of stuff that just is like too boring, right? And like maybe you're not as good at focusing on it because you're like, eh, like this doesn't really matter or like whatever. And so I do think, you know, I think there's a lot of it's almost like an ex-Olympian problem or like an ex-athlete problem where you have all these people that have competed at the absolute highest level. And then like, if you're not careful, the rest of life becomes super boring, right? And half of them end up alcoholics. So like, you know, they're like, like I already did the cool stuff. I certainly don't feel that way. I feel like there's all sorts of really interesting stuff to explore and do. But every once in a while, if I'm having a down day, you're like, I'm doing this thing, but like, does it matter? And once you've known or felt what it's like to really be at the white hot center of something, you know, it is a little bit hard to kind of compare and contrast, you know?
Thinking about your podcast, More or Less, by the way, great name. Compare and contrast that to another famous, that I'm not going to name the podcast, but another famous VC-led podcast. It seems to be like you don't really care that much about money. and compare and contrast with other famous people who speak out a lot in your industry. Do you care about money?
Sort of. I mean, here's what I basically say is, you know, I do, I would, first of all, it's a real luxury, which I think, you know, if I assume, I mean, I'll say it, I assume you're talking about the all-in guys. Like,
maybe,
you know,
yeah. Like, they've only... I don't want to get you in trouble, so I'm not going to mention any names.
You're not going to get in trouble. Like, that's one of the, at least in my head, I'm not a cancelable person, so it's fine. Look, I mean, the reality is everyone's done super well, right? Like, then no one wakes up and is worried about eating tomorrow. I actually think it's one of the great luxuries of Silicon Valley, right? Is that most people are not in such a free position, right? And where they can kind of think about how to spend their time and, you know, voice their opinions. They have people who kind of, or communities that stop them from saying things. And I think, like it or not like it, one of the nice parts about venture capital and kind of having been somewhat successful is you just get a lot of freedom, right? And so, do I care about making money? I am proud when we've been able to make a ton of money for our LPs and when your good decisions are quantified with financial returns, right? So, like, I am proud that, you know, we see at Solana, which, you know, we've been public about, and, you know, I made our firm and our LPs and our community a ton of money, right? Like, I'm proud of that. And I think that is a good way to keep score. But, I mean, look, we all, smart people know that money doesn't buy happiness. You know, I personally am not, you know, motivated. It just seems to me, Sam, you can do something incredibly interesting and important and impactful and make a little bit of money or make a ton of money doing something unbelievably boring. I'm clearly much more interested in doing something interesting and impactful than I am in just like money. So it is funny. I will say I have a hard time understanding people who have been, I understand completely if you have not been financially successful or you don't have security, you can't afford to buy nice things for your family or live a good life. I totally understand being focused on money. I think it's actually very reasonable. The reality is security is expensive, right? In a world of, you know, weird interest rates, like, you know, again, that is a very personal thing, which is how much do you need to feel secure in yourself? And I don't grudge people for whom that number can be quite high on like a normal basis. But I do think, like, you know, the guys, you know, the quote unquote other podcasts, the all-in guys, I think they like the game of it. And I respect that to a point. But I don't know. You know, there's a spectrum to these things.
Speaking of getting high off of ideas, which I can sense that you do, it's kind of interesting, your point of view, because normally when you think about venture capital, you have the capital and then the ideas come to you. But as a VC, and I mean, being a seed fund, it's maybe on the edge of VCs, it seems kind of like you're more of the ID guy. Have you ever thought about internalizing more? Because off the top of my head, you talked about the information becoming a kind of a new version of the Bloomberg terminal, selling printers that have some kind of DRM to print out the information. And then you invest in people, literally. And yep. Then I've heard you talk about, I'm trying to think, I didn't write this down, so I'm trying to think off the top of my head. There was a few more that was completely out there, but quite interesting. It's very unusual that a person that sits with the money also have so wild ideas. Have you thought about going in that direction, or is it just for fun you're doing it?
I think a few things. I'll give you a few answers to that. One is, you know, one of the cool parts about being an early stage investor, I actually think probably the part I like the most, is all of these really smart people come to you all day long, and basically you're paid to listen and learn from them what they've been spending years of their life figuring out, right? So you get exposed to a lot of really interesting ideas. Most of them are terrible. Some of them are super interesting, but these are people who are very serious about what they're doing and have spent a lot of time learning, right? And like, you get kind of the best continuous education ever. So I think that's kind of like when the ideas come to you, or like you get to cross-pollinate them, or like wow, that's an interesting thought, but that's not right. There's a lot to react to. You know, on a personal front, it's interesting. You know, I grew up as a product, right? Like, and I am a thesis-driven person. I like starting with frameworks and thinking about how to fill in the lines. You know, what I always say is there's kind of like three levels of an idea. The first idea is like, if there's something really, really amazing, sometimes you just have to build it yourself, right? And it's been fun. I actually recently have just started building products again for the first time in ages. And I do agree that building is by far the most fun and most gratifying. And so I think if it's super awesome, you should build it. right? If it's like a little bit less awesome, but still interesting, putting it out and figuring out how to invest in it or invest around the team is great. Find other people who are super passionate about it and do it. And then what I always say is, like, if you can't figure out how to invest in it, just write about it, right? And so there are all sorts of ideas that, like, I'll come up with or I'm excited about, or ideas I want to play with, and I just write about them. And
what are you interested in right now? Sorry to interrupt, but
things. I mean, like, I'm interested in franchise.
Like, literally today. What are you thinking
about?
Well,
I mean, like, I'll give you a very recent example. Maybe not this second, but, like, I was half joking, half serious, that someone needs to start something called Net Jets for farms, where a bunch of rich people can pay, like, $1 million a pop and buy into a farm network. And, like, there's a longer story about why this isn't the dumbest idea ever, but, like, I put that out as, like, a serious half joke thing, and then, you know, what happens is everyone writes back and, like, Sam, that's wrong, or Sam, that's right, or Sam, here's this interesting company that's doing something related. And I, like, learn a lot from that, and sometimes I get great deals from that. And so, to me, it's kind of, you know, I do like generating ideas, I like putting them out. Then the question is, like, what's the product of that? And it can just be writing and pushing the world forward, or pushing an idea and, like, giving someone else a new idea. It can be an investment, or in some cases, you're right, sometimes you do want to just build something, right? I think you kind of just think about that type of stuff.
By the way, the reason we do these interviews is primarily as a selfish way to learn.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way to do interviews. It's like, who do I want to talk to? Who do we want to talk to? And
totally.
Who do we want to learn from? And it really does work.
It totally works. Yeah. I mean, I'm with you. I mean, think about it. So yeah, I mean, I do the same thing with people come, you know, and they're looking for capital. It's like, I would never take a meeting, and I would always tell people, like, as I sometimes do, sometimes I say, look, there is no chance that we'll invest in this, but if you want to chat, I'm here to chat, you know, and I'll learn something. And, you know, sometimes people say, that's fine. Well, you know, I mean, I think they should spend their time elsewhere. People actually might give them money. And sometimes, like, no, like, I'd love to chat. I think you just learn a lot from people, you know?
You briefly mentioned your pitched great and terrible ideas. Do you have some outliers, like very, very bad ones and very, very good ones?
Oh, man. It's hard to say. I don't want to throw people under the bus. So the very, very bad ones, I think, are hard to ever bring up. But they do happen. The very good ones, I mean, like, look, you kind of look at our investment portfolio, in the investment portfolio parts I've done, and I'd say, like, most of those are people who I've either put something out, an idea out, and they've come back with a better idea. They're either yes and, like, that's actually wrong, Sam. I don't mind being wrong, by the way. But, like, I have a better version. Like, holy shit, that's a great idea. Would you like some money? Right? Like, that happens all the time. You know, or so that, so you look at our portfolio. I mean, I think, you know, one of my favorite versions of that is, you know, we're investors in a company called TeamShares, which I seeded very, very early on when really no one else was around and giving them money. It's kind of doing a very interesting approach to effectively buying and then improving small businesses. It's like a very oddball idea from a venture capital perspective, but it's crushing it, right? And so I think TeamShares is a good example of a weird idea at its time. You know, you mentioned investing in people. This is something I really believe in. We've now done many of these deals, and we'll do many more, where instead of buying equity in a company that produces a product, we kind of buy, you know, a small percentage of a personal holding company that kind of is the collection of everything a creator or is doing over the next 30 years. You know, I think those are going to turn out to be fabulously good deals, but they're very different. It's pretty odd, right? So, you know, there's all sorts of good stuff.
The only reason I'm not asking you more about this is because you've been interviewed about this quite a bit. So we have limited time. So.
Oh, good, man. I appreciate it. Whatever. I'm here for you.
I can suggest something that you might be thinking of as worst, because sure. It's so many. How many AI pitches have you gotten that are terrible in the last year?
Well, the good news is I'm getting less of them, fewer of them, because I've been so clear about the fact that I think AI pitches suck. So... that is one thing I think I'm very different than most of the Silicon Valley market on these days. I want to be really clear. I don't think that AI is not interesting technology. I think people are going to make a lot of money on it. I think the big brands are going to make a ton of money on it. Big platforms like Meta and Microsoft, et cetera, is going to be wild, right? And I think also very small companies can do super well with it. Because just like the cloud a generation ago, you know, we're in a place where all of a sudden the leverage of being a 3 or 4 or 5 person team and making really compelling products just went way up. So I think that'll be great. But I think the battle of traditional financing AI companies, which are extremely overpriced, have no defensibility against each other in terms of, you know, distribution or, you know, in terms of data. There's a bunch of reasons I think it's bad business. Now, look, there are exceptions. I mean, you know, there are companies that are pitching themselves as AI companies because that's what they think the market wants. But then when you talk to them, like, look, we're saying we're an AI company, but we're not really an AI company. Like, there's some of those that exist. But I do think, I think in general, the you know, the all the kind of wannabes who are doing Web3, yeah, you know, 2 years ago.
Oh my God, Web3, jeez.
AI now, and for all that.
Yeah, that was a terrible thing.
Well, again, I think the thing about, I'm actually very bullish on crypto. I think it's really important. We've been very focused on it. We continue to be. But I just think, you know, these things, these memes tend towards mania, right? On a lot of these things. And like, it's just, there are these moments where when, you know, it's not that complicated. When everyone's rushing in, it's probably a time to sell. When everyone's out, it's probably usually a time to get in, right? And I think in particular, I was actually just talking with an entrepreneur we invested in. We were talking about how you should not, the real danger zone is when people start fetishizing infrastructure, right? So, you know, when people are fetishizing Web3, and like the infrastructure was the interesting part, it's like time to get out. When people are fetishizing AI, which they are for sure now, it's time to not invest.
Back to IDs a little bit, because from your Instagram, I see you have a high focus on family life. And I don't have children, but I know people that do. And it seems to be a very sort of a part of being a father is to try to invent stuff to solve your problems that you are discovering. You feel like you're the first to discover. Did you invent a bunch of stuff in your head when you had especially smaller children?
You know, look, I've always, I love the game of inventing stuff, coming up with ideas. Again, I think I learned from my dad, who we certainly would walk through the woods and invent all sorts of stuff in our heads constantly. So I'm, you know, I'm all about that. I'm not sure. I mean, like, I adore my kids. I have a lot of fun with them. You know, they're only young for a little bit of time. And I love having the flexibility to spend a bunch of time with them. And they get more and more fun every year. So it's all great with them. I wouldn't say that we've invented a ton of stuff, like in the kids realm. You know, the trap of I'm a parent and now I see all the challenges of parenthood and therefore I've been like all the products is like, I guess one maybe I haven't fallen into, but I've always been one who was excited about solving my own problems anyway.
I'm assuming you watched the TV show Silicon Valley.
I have seen it, yes.
Is that accurate, by the way?
You know, it's kind of classic in that they have smart writers who obviously know a lot about Silicon Valley. There's a lot of shows like this, I find.
I think they have a lot of smart advisors, like the Twitter guys were advising them.
You know, like it's the same thing with, if you've seen the show Succession, is like, it's particularly funny if you actually know a lot of the characters that they're making fun of and the situations they're making fun of, because they're very on point. You know, I think with Silicon Valley, I mean, it was obviously silly, and the meta story wasn't, you know, it had its ups and downs, but like the little quirky things were always very funny to me. You know, the things they get right, the details. So
when I was thinking about the interview, I was thinking about a specific thing. I don't remember it. The lead character, I think he got fired or something, and he got a job offer at a company, and it was making this VR kind, no, or this AR mustache that was sort of attached to his face, like a trivial bullshit thing. And I know a VC, and he always would tell me about he invested in these like incredibly trivial things.
Yeah,
and I think that there's a lot of incredible, especially were a lot of incredible trivial products in that was backed by Silicon Valley. How do you avoid falling into these traps? Like you end up working with something like doesn't mean anything, or do you want to work with stuff like that?
Well, no. Look, I mean, I think every once in a while you end up doing that by accident, as like you know everyone's human. Everyone makes mistakes. You convince yourself on a Tuesday something matters, and by a Thursday you're like, oh, that doesn't actually matter. Or, like that was wrong, right? That happens, you know. Part of being a seed investor and being very early in the Silicon Valley ecosystem is I would argue that I'm in the rare job where like, it's kind of like baseball. If I'm right 2 out of 10 times, I'm crushing it, right? Like I mostly am wrong, right? But the key is to be extremely right every once in a while. And that means you're all the time investing in things like, oh, that was a mistake. Or like, I need to learn from that. Or like, that actually is trivial or whatever. You know, I do think that like the irreverence of doing weird shit is like actually great and like really important part of innovation. You know, Silicon Valley, I think one of the great parts about the US and Silicon Valley in particular in the US, is it's an unbelievably forgiving place of mistakes, which means that the cost of mistakes are very low, which means people are willing to experiment much more. You know, if you were in a world where, like, if you make one mistake, you'll never work again, it's very hard to take risks. And Silicon Valley is designed to encourage a lot of risk taking. And I think that's good. I mean, there are places that goes horribly wrong. People take risks that they should never have taken or irresponsibly. You know, there's a very big difference between being a seed investor and a diligence you do when you're doing a, you know, $1 million check versus a $100 million check of a company and governance and things like that. So, you know, it can go terribly wrong, but I actually think part of the magic is that you can end up doing, you can be wrong on tons of stuff and work on trivial stuff tons of time in the pursuit of doing really important stuff. Right. I think, you know, take Facebook as an example, since you brought it up before. It's like, you know, in the early days of Facebook, it was apparent to some people, and I'd like to say myself included, that this was a major fucking deal. It really mattered, right? And like had potential to be have global impact. But to most of the world, right, they'd say this is a silly college website, right? And I think that that actually, that debate is very legitimate in a lot of cases about whether this is important or silly, right? So that's kind of how I would think.
Can you tell us about the information and your internship there?
Well, look, my wife, my internship has been lifelong, and it basically is a context that I means I can help out when I can be helpful. It's my wife's company. She started it about 10 years ago. And, you know, as I usually like to point out, you know, she was at the Wall Street Journal. She got set up with it and their approach to the tech coverage in general, specifically, and decided to go start her own thing. And she said, decided to do it on a subscription basis where just everyone would pay her quality news and, you know, reporting the most important stories, which no one else is doing. And, you know, you can go Google it. People made fun of her. This will never work. Subscriptions don't work. Needs to be ads based. This was the era when Google had convinced all the major news organizations that to trade effectively and say, like, we'll give you reach in return for just having an ads model. You know, whatever. Almost 10 years later, obviously the joke's on that. You know, she's built a fabulous business. All those businesses have become more subscriptions based.
It's very successful.
It is. I mean, you know, she, if you actually want to learn about what's going on in Silicon Valley, she has the biggest BAPS reporting team focused specifically on tech world in the world. And they break, you know, a lot of their stories end up filtering through other publications because all the, you know, reporters then later report on what the information reported. But they're driving a lot of the narrative, and I'm super proud of her and them and the team for what they built. It's really awesome.
It's a very, very, very good website. And, it's there's quite a barrier now to go into new subscriptions. There are some that are really worth it, like Bloomberg, for instance, Financial Times, these things. But I think the information really is up there.
Cheers. I mean, I would agree.
Okay, I finally have a chance to figure something out. So I've been thinking about this point, and finally I have somebody to ask that can answer it. So I don't think video on the internet works financially. And I don't think it actually makes money. We've seen some huge successes like YouTube that have very limited insights into how much money they actually make. And I just think that the infrastructure is so incredibly expensive, and anyone who's ever hosted video know how expensive it is. And you simply cannot make it up no matter how you slice it. First of all, is that true? And do you think that there is some kind of solution when you look at, for instance, the... like the new Meta Quest headset, and you think about the stuff they call avatars, where you have a mapping of your face that's 100% realistic, and effectively you're only sending metadata across the internet.
So I'm not sure you're right that video doesn't make money. I mean, first, I think by all accounts, YouTube is wildly profitable. I'd also point out the fact that like Instagram and also TikTok are basically video websites at this point, and they're massively profitable. So I think that you definitely can make money, and like, sure, it's more expensive than other things, you know, to host and serve video, but it's not that expensive. I think the question more is like, it is a war of attrition for attention. And so the question is, you know, can you compete for attention at this point in a productive way? You know, I'd argue, you know, you take like, you talk about the platforms, you talk about individuals. It's like Mr. Beast, you know, has clearly figured out how to like build an empire around video, like mass entertainment. You know, we back a lot of creators who use video content to become, you know, they pay for it, they develop it, and it's massively profitable for them because they find all sorts of ways of building and monetizing that community. So I don't know. Long-winded way of saying, like, I'm not actually sure. I think you're right that it's more expensive than text, obviously, to like put up in post. But I also think it's so much more monetizable that, in general, I'm pretty bullish on it. You know, I think if you want to go in a different direction, I would say I think that a lot of the streaming media services, I think, are much more challenging. Right? This is the Netflixes and the Hulus and the Disney Pluses and whatever. That's where content is unbelievably expensive, and there are only 24 hours in a day. So they're constantly competing for subscribers and attention with everyone else, and that's a hard game to win in terms of profitability.
Yeah, I think you're a very good answer. I finally got some clarity. And I was thinking about the sort of entertainment services, but also in the scope that I'm unsure about how much of the costs of YouTube we actually see. But you're right, it's very monetizable.
Yeah,
so, especially TikTok, maybe.
Look, my understanding is that the major video platforms, which we call, you know, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube, are massively profitable. I do think that to your point, the places where you pay very high costs, you know, the professional content platforms with subscriptions are, I think, much more challenging, mostly because they just compete with each other so viciously. And then they're also competing with free content, which is difficult.
How long have you been in? Do you live in Silicon Valley?
I moved out to San Francisco, originally Palo Alto, in 2010. I've been here ever since.
So something changed. I don't know what it was, and I don't know when it was, but so many people in your circle, I mean, VCs, tech people, unnamed richest people in the world, so many people became assholes and kind of evil. When did that happen? And why did that happen?
I think it's a really interesting framing. I wouldn't say they're evil. What I would say is, though, that I think they definitely don't mind being contrarian, and sometimes some of them are mean. Evil strong, though. Like, I think the idea, I don't think there's any like bad, I don't think any person is running around Silicon Valley, even the people that you and I might dislike the most, and being like, I'm going to destroy the world, or like, I'm the bad guy. They all think they're the good guy. And, you know, a lot of them are, it's complicated characters. Like, they have a lot right, and they're right about a lot of stuff, but then there's a few things they're pretty wrong about. You know, I think you can point to some of the fraud stories, whether that's FTX or Elizabeth Holmes or debatably other companies, and say, well, that is pretty evil, and like Silicon Valley can't tolerate that. That's going to destroy the culture of Silicon Valley. I think there's some truth to that. Those are bad cases that it should not be enabled. But it's a hard one. I do think what you found, though, is that, you know, if nothing else, I'll give you this, which is the people in the internet era who became leaders or grew, you know, they grew mass followings with no oversight in a very unique and interesting way that's never existed. Right. So if you think about it, even really successful people historically always had to speak through an intermediary. And the fact they had to speak through a newspaper or through something else always moderated what they could and couldn't say. And candidly, probably cleaned up a bunch of mistakes and prevented a lot of bad stuff. It also probably blocked some good stuff. Like, it was very moderated. There's no question this is the first generation of a bunch of billionaires who are directly followed, can say whatever they want. Right. And then I do think, again, this very contentious relationship, whereas if you think about it, now that they can say whatever they want, all the good news, they just announce themselves. You know, how great they are, the good things they're doing, whatever. They don't need the media for that. But then all the bad news they want to cover up. And the media is left in this position being like, well, we don't get to report all the good stuff. So I guess we have to report on only all the bad stuff. And that creates a very high friction relationship between the media and, I mean, some very successful people at this point, where like, they're like, why is the media only over reporting the bad stuff? And like, they're about to get us. It's like, well, it's a little more complicated than that. It's also more complicated because you're already seeing all the good stuff. So all the media can do that's unique is counterbalance that, right? Which creates kind of more contentious relationship than I think historically existed.
Since I'm also now in a little bit deeper water, we're almost done now. So I've never heard you mention Elon Musk once.
What about him?
What do you think?
Oh, I think it's complicated. I mean, look, there's a lot of stuff he says and does I think I completely agree with, you know, and I think he really should get credit for. Like, candidly, like, I am a big believer in free speech. And, you know, I think a lot of his rhetoric around it, let's set aside what he actually does, is right. I do believe in a lot of his kind of like aspirational messages for the planet. Like, I think people need things to be wake up and be excited about, and whether that's traveling to Mars or whatever, like, I think he's a great inspirational leader that way. You know, I think a lot of what he kind of pointed out and did in Silicon Valley, cutting headcount and like, we need to rationalize and make good businesses, also like gave a lot of cover to a lot of other people to do very rational, good things. And I believe in his ability to just like say, fuck it. I'm not like here to be liked. I'm here to be right. And do stuff. So I like that. The things I don't like, I think he is, I worry most that he's blatantly lies about stuff. Right? I think one of the things about the culture of high trust is that you have to have high trust. And, you know, this is going back 10 years when he was talking about, you know, self-driving cars around the corner. And I was like indignant about this. Like, I know there's no fucking chance, right? Like, and, you know, he's a habitual liar on that stuff, you know. You know, Hugh might claim there's a difference between, you know, belief and lying. I think when you know for a fact something is not going to happen and you say it anyway, that lying just destroys a lot of trust. I think it takes a lot of credit for a lot of other people. You know, I think that the reality is most tech leaders are constantly pushing credit to their team. He's constantly taking credit for everything. I think that's like a pretty bad look. You know, I don't know. So I think he's a really complicated character, which makes him really challenging, because if he was just all bad, it'd be easy. You'd just be like, this guy's the worst, right? But the problem is he's not. He's right about a lot of things. And then, you know, he's extremely wrong. I think a terrible role model in a lot of other ways. And then he does stuff that's just mean, right? You know, which I just see is like completely unnecessary. Whether it was like pedo meat or whatever else, you're like, dude, you're like, why would you? You're such an awful representation of what we would hope from people in power, right? So I don't know. At the long way, I would say, like, I find him very complicated.
That's a very political, and I mean that in a good way, answer.
Well, I mean, like...
and I like the balance. The balance is good.
He's definitely not my friend, right? Like, he's kind of a jerk, but, like, I also think you have to acknowledge the things that he's good at, right?
Yeah, of course. But he's so important, so I have to ask about him specifically. Have you met him, personally?
I have met him. I haven't spent time with him in a long time, but I've met him. I had dinner sitting next to him once. I've had a one-on-one conversation with him a long time ago before he was known as Elon he is today. I think he's a fun dinner partner. He's smart. He reads science fiction. Like, you know, he's a fun guy to talk to. But again, I think he's embarrassing in a lot of ways. And I also think he's like doing some terrible stuff. I mean, I think it's, well, the Twitter thing's a whole other fiasco.
So we have about 1 minute left of our allotted time.
Her stilte jeg et spørsmål som dessverre kanskje er konfidensielt, så han kunne ikke svare på det. Bare for å plage dere litt, så kan jeg legge inn hva svaret hans var. Her svarer han på spørsmålet etter litt diskusjon.
The answer is, I've never told you a lie in the world's smallest.
But okay. Sam, thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank you for your time. It was very interesting, very thought-provoking.
Yeah, nice to speak with you. Come say hi out west.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.